Okay, thanks. Thanks for the invitation. Oops, I should have asked for a pointer before I started. There it is. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about some work that I've done over the past year with Josef Banja, three papers, one appear shortly. The title actually refers to this paper in preparation, but I'll go through some of the background involved in these papers. So the supertube and the 4D black hole part of the story can be summarized as follows. So the concrete goal here is going to be to find smooth supergravity solutions for the ground state of the BPS four-dimensional black hole. One construction of the four-dimensional black hole is as D1, D5, KK system. If you want to add, to make it give it entropy, you'd add momentum. If you turn off the momentum, that's what I'm calling the ground state of the black hole. And let me offer some motivations for why this is an interesting thing to look for. Well, first of all, there's sort of been this program recently of looking for smooth supergravity solutions for microstates of various theories, various conformal field theories related to ABS-CFT. And most of these solutions are 1/2 BPS or 1/4 BPS. And it's interesting to push that as far as one can go. This will be a 1/8 BPS three-charge solution, so that makes it interesting. From the point of view of ADS-CFT, we know the conformal field theory that's dual to this system, the D1, D5, KK. It's closely related to the CFT, the more familiar D1, D5 system. It's half as much supersymmetry in this case, but it's a known 4-0 CFT with a known central charge and so forth. And so these solutions will provide the Kawa primaries of that conformal field theory, so dual geometries for the Kawa primaries. Now, there's also motivation for this based on these black ring solutions that have been discussed recently by people here and everywhere. If one looks at these BPS black rings, which in general have non-zero entropy and horizons and so forth, but if one takes the parameters such that one turns off the entropy, one might hope that these solutions would then represent some sort of microstate things of some dual conformal field theory. However, if one just turns off the entropy, one finds that these BPS black rings are singular. But the singularity is closely tied to this system that I'm looking at. The singularity is controlled by the geometry near the ring, which in fact is that of the D1, D5, Klutze-Klein monopole system. So the hope would be, I'm not going to be able to sort of realize this last step, but the hope would be that if one understands how to resolve this singularity, as we do, then one could sort of glue that smoothing into the black ring and get these smooth solutions for that system. Okay, now of course, in sort of a larger, more semi-philosophical vein, there's been a lot of discussion by Mathur and others about whether we can understand black hole entropy in terms of a large set of smooth solutions of supergravity. And I'm not going to be sort of making direct contact with that in the sense that I'm not going to be looking at solutions in which I'm in the black hole regime. Nevertheless, I'm sort of widening the class of supergravity solutions dual to microstates. So there are applications sort of off in that direction, but not directly.
So, particularly, I guess it's easier to do this in four dimensions than five, where the three-charge, five-dimensional black hole would have non-zero.
That's right. So, if I had three charges in five dimensions, I would have non-zero entropy. And so this is easier in the same sense that just putting two charges in five dimensions is easier than three charges in five dimensions. And as I'll say at the end, I mean, if I tried to take this three-charge thing, you might naively say, well, let's dualize this into D1, D5P, and get something with non-zero entropy. But because it's in four dimensions, if I dualize it, I'll get D1, D5P smeared over some extra dimension. That smearing kills the entropy. So I can't get these things directly in sort of the black hole regime by this construction. Okay, so what are the basic results here going to be for these solutions? So part of our ansatz for finding solutions, we'll assume some symmetry. We'll assume some U1 cross U1 invariants. And then we'll find all the solutions of those geometries. And we understand precisely which set of chiral primaries of the CFT those correspond to. So this is one of these orbifold CFTs, like for the D1, D5 system. And some sort of long string, and you can sort of think of breaking that string up into little components. More technically, these are twist operators of the orbifold. And so all these things with the symmetry are all basically correspond to equal length cycles, so all the twists have equal lengths. That preserves the U1 invariant, and then, so we understand all those geometries. As I said, these are going to be asymptotically flat in four dimensions. And the one sort of semi-unexpected feature is that we started off looking for the D1, D5, KK system, which means the Klutze-Klein monopole means there's some magnetic charge in that system. And once we go and actually work this thing out in asymptotically flat space, we're going to be forced to find actually there's some Kaluza-Klein electric charge as well turned on. So there's some Kaluza-Klein magnetic charge given by the number of Kaluza-Klein monopoles, and then some electric charge in that same Kaluza-Klein direction given by the product and number of one brains and five brains divided by this integer n, which classifies our solutions, basically the length of these twist cycles. And then in retrospect, this is almost sort of expected because these solutions also have angular momentum. Angular momentum takes this form and expressed in terms of the magnetic and electric charges, it's 1/2 magnetic times electric. The n's are the quantized things. Now, one knows from electromagnetism that if one has a widely separated electric charge or magnetic charge, just in the field, there's angular momentum in that field, and the angular momentum is precisely 1/2 magnetic charge times electric charge. And so the way I'd like to think about this is sort of consistent with these solutions being marginally stable. So if I had less angular momentum than this in the solution, then I wouldn't be able to separate out the electric and magnetic charges off to infinity by angular momentum conservation. So this is as when if I could separate them out, I could serve angular momentum. That's sort of consistent with me by marginal stability. So I think in the end, that's an expected feature. Okay, so let me begin by sort of reviewing the naive metric for the system. Then I'll eventually take some detours and discuss some aspects of black rings and then come back to the real metrics of these things. Okay, so the one probably reasonably familiar to most people, but not familiar to everybody, is the Kaluza-Klein monopole solution. So just looking at the Kaluza-Klein monopole for a second, ignoring the D1 and D5, how do we describe that system? Well, it's the Taub-Nutt metric, four-dimensional Euclidean metric, and we just attach on Minkowski space and the extra six dimensions, although I'm going to want to compactify two of these directions, sorry, four of these directions. Okay, so the Taub-Nutt metric is as follows. It's following four-dimensional metric. There's this flat three-dimensional base, and there's a fiber, psi is a compact coordinate, so this thing's asymptotically, this part here is asymptotically R3 cross S1, and so I have a Kaluza-Klein gauge field, and this is the vector potential of that Kaluza-Klein gauge field, and you recognize that as the gauge field of some magnetic charge. Okay, there's some harmonic function multiplying these things. And the magnetic charge is quantized, a la Dirac. In this case, by demanding the absence of a Dirac string, the phi coordinate is breaking down here when sine theta goes to zero. So you have to make sure there's no, you want to zero out the component in front of d phi. And here I've done that at cosine theta equals one, but then at cosine theta equals minus one, one has to shift the psi coordinate to cancel that off. Being able to do a shift like that where maintaining periodicities means there's this quantization condition. Okay, and the other thing that will be important is the small r behavior of this Taub-Nutt metric. So let's go to small r, with harmonic functions dominated by this term, do a series of coordinate transformations, and eventually I get something looking like the metric on just looking like R4, except for this three-sphere part here has some identifications. So there's some Zn identifications on the three-sphere. So this is S3 mod Zn, and in fact then this metric is singular at the origin, R4. Mod Zn, of course, but this is a perfectly allowed singularity in string theory that we can handle, so we're not really worried about that. Okay, then we go add in the D1 and D5 brains just by the usual harmonic function rule, just attaching on harmonic functions to the D1 and D5. So the common direction, the D1 direction, is x5. x5 is going to be a compact coordinate. And here I have my Taub-Nutt. The T4, I'm basically going to say nothing more about. The T4 just goes along for the ride. It really does nothing in the story. It's sort of the six-dimensional metric here that's of interest. And, okay, now the near-horizon geometry. So the story, before we had the singular R4 mod Zn, now when you add in the D1 and D5 brains, that S3 stabilizes at finite size, like when you get the normal ADS3 cross S3. And so now you get a smooth geometry, ADS3 cross S3 mod Zn. This is a perfectly smooth Zn identification. And the ADS scale depends on all the charges like this. Okay, so things are smooth in the S3, but things are not smooth in the ADS direction. And one is ADS, in particular ADS in Poincaré coordinates, just taking this thing for small r, but if x5 is a compact coordinate, if I want to have this thing go down to four dimensions, I need it to be compact, then you have this problem with taking ADS in Poincaré and compactifying it, and the x5 cycle. So you go down to the ADS horizon at z equals infinity, that x5 cycle shrinks to zero size, and so there's a singularity. So So the reason this is the naive metric is the metric is singular. No curvature singularity, but there is a cycle shrinking to zero size. Okay, so we want to get metrics that will smooth out that singularity, essentially. Okay, what do we know about things from the conformal field theory point of view? So the more familiar case of D1, D5 conformal field theory has, so it breaks one quarter, I mean, it brings you down to one quarter of the original 32 supercharges, so it's 8 supercharges in terms of the CFT, it's 4, 4. Now, associated with each half here, there's some R symmetry. So the R symmetry is SU2 cross SU2. That's SO4, and that's just the rotations on the S3. Now, to get to the data in the KK metric, as we saw, we replace S3 by S3 mod ZN. That kills, that identification kills the SU2 on the right. So the remaining R symmetry, rotation symmetry, is just single SU2, corresponding to now having just half as much supersymmetry, 4, 0 supersymmetry. This is the central charge. It's easy enough to work out. Okay, so then one has this conformal field theory with this central charge and this supersymmetry, and then one can ask for supersymmetric ground states of that system, the Ramond ground states on the left of the left movers. Okay, so these things, the way to think about these is they carry physically angular momentum. I have, easiest way to think about it is I have a bunch of fermions, and I can have the fermion zero modes carry angular momentum when you quantize them, so I can align those zero modes in various ways, and I get a whole range of angular momentum anywhere in this range. Okay, and then using the value of C, I see that I get J less than 1/2, anywhere from minus this to plus that. Okay, so one way to think about it is in terms of these Ramond ground states. Alternatively, you can describe this in terms of chiral primaries of the system. So in CFT, if you do a spectral flow, that relates Ramond ground states to chiral primaries. From the point of view of these bulk geometries, the spectral flow is simply a diffeomorphism. So you do a change of coordinates that takes you back and forth. You can talk about equally well chiral primaries or Ramond ground states. They're really the same geometries. Okay, so that was the naive metric. Now, eventually, we're going to write down do better than the naive metric, get something smooth. And the way these geometries are smoothed out is basically the same way as for these D1, D5 metrics that have been around for a long time. The D1 and D5 expand out into some supertube structure, into some Kaluza-Klein monopole supertube. And this expansion, the Kaluza-Klein monopole is a smooth geometry, so the expansion into a smooth geometry makes the whole solution smooth. Okay, so all right. So with that in mind, I want to now go and review quickly aspects of supertubes that I'll need in this construction, and then at the end, as I said, come back to the actual construction of these geometries. Okay, so let's start with the simplest. Let's look at the simplest supertube for a moment. So the way I like to think about this is starting with a flat brain with some fluxes on it, and then see why we can, at no cost and energy, make that brain wiggle, curl it up into a tube, and why that remains BPS. So let's take a DP brain, flat DP brain in these directions, and turn on some fluxes. In particular, turn on what naively is a critical electric field strength in the two direction and some magnetic field. So in the presence of the magnetic field, this isn't really critical anymore, since it's really E squared minus B squared that's the crucial thing. This is actually subcritical when you have a magnetic field turned on. But here I've drawn some little chunk of the brain, and let's just see what sort of charges are induced. Well, one knows that electric flux in general induces fundamental string charge along the two direction, and so indeed there are some number of fundamental strings. And when you plug this into the Born-Infeld, you find the number of fundamental strings is 1 over the magnetic field. It's proportional to the electric flux for weak electric fields, but for strong electric fields, it's actually 1 over the B field. Then you induce dp minus 2 brain charge corresponding to the amount of magnetic flux. So in this system here, there's some magnetic flux piercing the plane, and the amount of magnetic flux basically tells you the amount of dp minus 2 brain charge. Then I have electric magnetic fields present, so from usual sort of electromagnetism E cross B sort of thing, I get momentum in the one direction given by this formula. Now eventually we're going to take this flat tube and curl it up into a circle, in which case this momentum is going to become angular momentum circulating around, and so that in mind I'm going to call it J. So J is momentum times, eventually this is going to be a circle of radius R. And then so the momentum is given by this formula, therefore, plugging in that value of P1. Okay, so one works out the energy of this thing, plugs these fluxes into the Born-Infeld action. You find the Born-Infeld action is basically just B. So what is the energy? Well, PQ dot minus L. In this case, PQ dot is the electric field giving the fundamental strings. and the L here is B, giving the P minus two brains. And so you get this energy corresponding to the amount of fundamental strings and dp minus two brains. And the crucial thing is there's no contribution of the energy from the original dp brains that you started with. That just goes away essentially from this electric field. Essentially, it just acts as a little template to put your lower dimensional brains on, but then it doesn't contribute anything more. So it's a BPS, and the dp brain pretty much disappears from the supersymmetry projectors and energy and so forth. Okay, so that's the flat brain. How do you convince yourself that you can make this brain wiggle and curve it up? Well, let's quantize open strings moving on this brain. So that's easy enough to do. Anytime you have fluxes on a brain, you just write down an open string metric, and you have the same sort of correlators you normally would, except for the modified metric and some anti-commutivity parameter, which won't play any role here. Now, the key thing is one takes those fluxes, writes down the open string metric, and the one thing to notice is the metric with raised indices in the 1-1 direction vanishes. It vanishes, so if you take the correlator between two x1 fields, you get zero. So that gives you a large, easy way of constructing lots of primary vertex operators, dimension one primaries. You take some ordinary vertex operator that would, say, describe just translation, rigid translation of the brain, and that's a physical. Then for free, you can just attach on anything with any x1 dependence. Since this vanishes, that doesn't change any of the physical state conditions or the dimension or anything else. So this is a good vertex operator. And now, since I can do this for any P1 dependence, I can make the brain wiggle locally. So instead of having to just translate rigidly, I can make it vibrate locally. And I don't add any energy or charges, I just add momentum in the one direction. Okay, so I can take these operators, add them, like add multiple operators, exponentiate, get some finite deformation of the brain. That's all allowed. So I can have some curved DP brain and eventually curl it up entirely into a circle, in which case, as I said, the J becomes, honest to goodness, angular momentum given by this relation. Okay, so that's the basic supertube construction. And if one takes, instead of having to be circular, one could take the thing to be ellipsoidal or curved or whatever, then you'll find less angular momentum. This is the maximal angular momentum you can get by this construction. Okay, a couple comments. If one works out what is the radius of this supertube, you'll find the radius goes, r squared goes like the string coupling. So if you're thinking of sort of quantizing these objects, it's a little bit different than how we normally think about the relation between brains and gravity. Often when I have some, say, black hole made out of brains, I like to turn off the string coupling, look at that brain in the absence of gravity, count things up, and then extrapolate back. Here I can't really do that, at least not so naively. If I turn off the string coupling, this whole radius, finite radius size of the tube just shrinks down to zero size. And I lose the original DP brain that I was working on, that I was working with. So it makes the counting at weak coupling more subtle, and some of the entropy countings of these black rings and black tubes and so forth have that sort of intrinsic subtlety attached to them. On the other hand, if you're thinking about this in terms of black hole physics, this is actually a nice relation. These objects expand out at strong coupling, so the regime where gravity would be valid, these brains also have a nice finite size and might actually expand out with the size of the horizon and give a way of thinking about the underlying microscopic structure of the black hole in terms of these extended finite size floppy objects. Okay, so so one thing that Yosef and I did, his point of view was to generalize these supertubes to have three charges, since if one wants to make contact with the D1, D5, P black hole, one wants three charges. Now, we didn't just write down a supertube with D1, D5, P. If one wants to use a supertube construction, the critical part of that was turning on this electric flux. And so along with the electric flux always comes fundamental string charge. So instead of taking these charges, let's dualize a few times and dualize into D0, D4, F1. Okay. Now, what sort of things would this expand into? Well, if D0 and F1 expanded to D2, that was the previous thing, then dualize that statement, and you find that D4 and F1 expanded to D6, D0, D4 expanded to NS5. So we'd look for some sort of construction with these three conserved charges, D0, F1, D4, and these three dipole charges. Now, it's easy enough to do that except for the NS5 brain. Okay, so what you'd like to do here is take the largest dimension brain appearing in this construction, D6. You'd like to take some D6, put a bunch of fluxes, induce the lower dimensional charges and dipole charges. But you can't put fluxes on a D brain and induce NS5 brain charge. The NS5 brain is simply too heavy. Okay, so for a Born infinite construction, one can only do this in the absence of the NS5. Now, there's some workarounds. One could T-dualize, replace NS5 by the Kaluza-Klein monopole, and then have the thing sitting, as we said, in the core. That's orbifold singularity, and one can put the brains of the orbifold and use well-known techniques. That's one workaround. Or one can work in M-theory, as folks here have done. And these things have various advantages and disadvantages, which I'm not going to go into now. But let's suppose we constructed effectively, essentially, the super tube with all those charges, with those, including the NS5 dipole ring charge. So again, let's begin with a case where the thing is flat and ask, what do we know microscopically about this flat brain carrying all these charges, given here? Well, with all these charges, this is a six-dimensional object. If I compactify that thing on T6, just keeping it flat, not putting it into a tube, that'll yield a four-dimensional black hole with non-zero entropy. Now, we know a lot about that system. We can understand the entropy microscopically. This has been done following this approach of M-theory approach of Maldacena, Strominger, and Witten. And various groups have generalized that construction to turn on more charges and fluxes and so forth. And so it's actually known how to compute the entropy microscopically. And indeed, that entropy can also be, I mean, know what the entropy is going in, because the entropy has to be invariant under E77. That's the duality group in four dimensions. And there's a unique formula given by the quartic invariant of that duality group. Okay, so this is the general entropy formula for all these black holes. And it's just a question of identifying all these parameters that appear in the E7 charges with the number of brains that appear in your construction. Okay, so one can read that off by the compactification, read off what charges are. All these things. And so that's just the construction of the ordinary four-dimensional black hole. But now, as in the previous supertube construction, instead of having this thing be flat, you can make it curve it up into a tube. Okay, same sort of construction as before. And then I lose one flat dimension, replace it by a circle. So now I can compactify this thing on T5, and eventually then get an object with topology S1 cross S2, which of course is this black ring that sure people are aware of. So by these sort of arguments, knowing about the microscopics of the four-dimensional black hole, knowing about supertubes, one could essentially predict the existence of this black ring carrying this entropy. I'm changing the history somewhat. We didn't predict this entropy form of this black ring, but as a sort of narrative, I'm doing it this way. Well, we'll see that, in fact, is the case. The entropy does take that form. There's a somewhat related approach by these authors where they, again, mapped it to the similar system and did accounting directly in M-theory, and there's some subtle differences in their approach with our approach, where they work in terms of charges infinity instead of charges at the ring, and then they add in this non-extensive term, and we don't really understand the relation between these. One should say that this last step of taking the flat brain and then curving one direction into a circle is, there's some assumptions there, because if I know the entropy for an infinite flat brain, I could assume the entropy is extensive. And then say, well, so just get the entropy per unit volume and then curl under the circle and just multiply by the volume. But of course, there could be non-extensive contributions. And the difference between these two approaches seems to be in how one deals with those non-extensive contributions. Okay. Right, so then these supergravity solutions for the three charged supertubes were found, as you know, generalized further in various ways. These black rings carry D1 in a certain frame, in a 2B frame, carry D1 charge, D5 charge momentum, as well as these dipole moments that I talked about. Now, these charges are the real, honest to God, conserved charges you measure infinity. Now, I claim that to understand the entropy form in terms of microscopic analysis, one should think of this ring as being made up of these charges n bars, which are defined in this way. This is a somewhat controversial statement, I realize. But it's essentially a hypothesis at this point, but I'm saying that make this assumption with the charges, and I claim this would lead to the easiest way of understanding the entropy microscopically. Okay? So, people in the room, I'm sure, disagree. Okay. So, now, I'm not going to write down these full solutions. Let me mention at this point that a couple of key features for later. One is that these solutions have things that look like harmonic functions, but these harmonic functions aren't harmonic anymore. So there's a 1 over sigma thing. So these things are black rings. So there's some thing here, looks like a harmonic function, source that sigma equals 0. Sigma equals 0 is a ring. Radius r, cos theta equals 0. And then there's a second piece, which is not harmonic. Okay, so harmonic functions are not harmonic anymore. Now, these solutions include the good old BMPV black hole, the rotating D1, D5 P black holes in special case, take the radius of the ring to zero, you get back to that case. And they also include the two-charge supertubes as a special case. So they sort of combine all these special cases together and give a nice general solution. These things carry angular momentum, and it's nice to think about them as carrying two types of angular momentum. This helps you sort of see that they're a combination of the BMPV black hole and the supertubes. So the BMPV black hole has equal but opposite sign angular momentum in the phi plane and the psi plane. Okay, so this thing's asymptotically five dimensional, so I have some SO4 rotation group, two angular momenta. And then J psi, for this case, gets an extra contribution, which I'll call J tube. It's very similar to the angular momentum coming in the supertube construction. Okay, and it, in particular, J tube is coming from the finite size of the object. The dipole charges and the radius come in. Okay, so then with the definitions I made, one works out the entropy of the black ring solution and gets this formula. And then you note, indeed, this is the same formula as I wrote down previously. It is this E7 invariant J4, provided you identify the brains in the flat case with the n bars in this case. Okay, so if you don't make that identification, you have to do something else to explain why these formulas agree. Okay, then, of course, these solutions have 7 free parameters, only 5 conserved charges, so they have a form of hair, which makes these things really interesting to think about. And so from this entropy counting I've given so far, of course, I sort of really understand the hair, because I map this thing to this flat 4D black hole where all the charges and dipole charges sort of appear, you know, locally as real charges. So I sort of understood the hair in that sense. But as I'll review in the next page, these metrics are also asymptotic. If you take the decoupling limit, the near horizon decoupling limit, asymptotic to the usual ADS3 cross S3 cross T4 geometry of the D1D5P system. So you could hope to understand this entropy formula in the same CFT as you understand the entropy formula for the old Stroman-Dravatha black hole, D1D5P. And so that's where it's more challenging to understand what this hair would be from that point of view. From the point of view where I'm out of the 4D black hole, it's completely clear. Okay, so let's understand the decoupling limit. That's pretty straightforward for these black rings. You just drop the ones from the harmonic functions of D1D5, keep it in the P thing. That's actually the standard thing to do. And then, as I said, you see this is asymptotic to the same ADS3 cross S3 T4 as the usual D1D5P thing, P solution. So you could hope to understand the solution as some ensemble of states in that same CFT. But clearly, I'm going to have to do more than just fix the conserved charges, since I have these extra dipole charges as well. So how do we normally deal with the CFT, the D1D5 CFT? Well, normally, all we can really do in general is work at the orbifold point of that CFT, where it's a free theory. We know that's not really valid. That's not where supergravity is valid, so I can only do some things there. We know that some things fail if you make that assumption. But if I do that work at this point, what that means is, as I said before, I have this effective string of length N1, N2. This would be the number of D1 brains and number of phi brains in my notation now. And it's an orbifold CFT, meaning you can take this effective string and it can be broken up into little component strings. Those are the length of the twists. Each component has, this is supersymmetric, so there are 4 bosons and 4 fermions. The fermions are doublets under the R symmetry rotation group. That's what gives the angular momentum of the thing. And these R symmetry generators are related to the rotation generators by this combination. Okay, so the sort of hope would be that since these black ring solutions sort of combine properties of the BMPV black hole and the two-charge supertubes, and we know, I'm not going to review this, but we certainly know how to describe the BMPV and two-charge supertubes or entropy and so forth in terms of the CFT. So I think it's a reasonable hope that one could explain the black ring entropy in the same orbifold limit of the CFT. Okay, so how far can one get with that? I'm going to skip a lot of the details here to sort of summarize the general result. So here's our proposal for how you do this. So let's take the full effective string of the CFT and divide it into 2 parts. We're claiming this thing is sort of made up of the supertube and the BMPV. So let's break this thing up into 2 parts. The entire length of the string is given by N1, N2. Break it up into a BMPV string and a tube string. So the BMPV string we're going to treat just like when you do the entropy counting of the BMPV black hole. Tube string we're going to treat just like when you do the entropy counting for the supertube. So in particular, the BMPV string is going to carry the momentum of the system. It's going to carry the entropy, etc. The tube string, we think of this as, again, this orbifold CFT, so we can break it up into a bunch of components, break up this tube string into components of length L sub C, and let that carry what I call the tube angular momentum in the fermion zero modes. Okay, so there's two components, two contribution angular momentum. The J tube comes from the tube string. BMPV angular momentum comes from the BMPV string. And well, if you assumed how length each component is, then the number of components is L tube over LC. Each component basically carries one unit angular momentum, so that fixes the tube angular momentum to be related to these L tube and LC by this formula. Okay, so there are there's something non-trivial here. There are more things to explain than you have free parameters, but we can't in general explain all the parameters from a rigorous microscopic argument. So in particular, one has to make some assumption for the length of these component strings. This isn't really too surprising. As I said, this picture of component strings, I mean, is known to be invalid in some way. It's known that to go off into where the supergravity description is valid, you turn on expectation values of twist fields in the CFT. When you turn on expectation values of twist fields, the notion of some little component string isn't valid. And so there's some extrapolation here, which one can't justify, but we're seeing how far we can get with this. So for a large class of states, something very nice happens. The length of the component strings is the same length as it would have been for the ordinary two-charge supertube. So that's sort of your natural guess, and that explains the entropy of a large class of states. More generally, you have to make just a phenomenological assumption of what those lengths are. Okay, so some formula. But then once one makes that assumption, one has non-trivial checks about explaining. One has to explain, the angular momentum, both components of angular momentum, the entropy, and so forth. So I think there is something non-trivial that happens there. Okay, so I don't want to dwell too much on that. That's all I have to say on the entropy. Okay, so now let me get into the issue of motivating this search for these solutions of the D1, D5, KK system. So let's look back at the supergravity geometry of these black rings. Let's look very near the ring and see again why we're getting this singularity. So if we take the decoupling limit, asymptotically, as you said, we have the CFT of the D1, D5 P system. This usual 4, 4 CFT of the central charge. Okay, now we look at the geometry near the ring. Near the ring, what's happening is as far from the ring, the actual conserved charges are dominating. So you see the D1, D5, P. Near the ring, the dipole charges are dominating, and the dipole charges are those of D1, D5, and KK. So near the ring, the thing is looking, it's like an RG flow, essentially. You're flowing between where the real charges dominate and the dipole charges. So near the ring, you're seeing the CFD of the D1, D5, KK system, as I said, with half as much supersymmetry and a different central charge. And note indeed that the IR central charge is less than the UV central charge, which is a good check. Now, so how does that RG flow work? Well, let's take the simplest case. Let's do some change of coordinates and then go down towards the ring. Okay, you make a change of coordinates. You do indeed see that the geometry near the ring is ADS3 cross S3 mod ZN times T4, the expected geometry of this. But there's some funny things in this sort of flow. What this is saying is you flow in to R equals 0 to understand the IR geometry. Things like the tildes are the new coordinates. X tilde is the light cone direction in the ADS direction. It actually gets related to an angular direction in the original UV solution. So the angular direction at infinity gets related to the ADS direction as you go in, which is kind of puzzling, sort of this interchange. Well, puzzling, it's intriguing, this interchange between the R symmetry and the conformal symmetry. And what that means is that this coordinate in ADS has to be compact, okay? Because it's coming from the original psi direction, which is the direction on the sphere, which is compact. Okay, and this is just to say that the ADS radius is getting determined by the dipole charges. Okay, so this leads to the singularity. The ADS3 direction is singular because the ADS, this is Poincaré ADS, and the ADS direction is compact. Okay, so we want to smooth out that singularity. Okay, so we just focus on that local region, and so I want to ask now, let's look for supergravity geometries for D1, D5, KK. So, or if you'd like, you can forget about the motivation of the black rings. It's just an interesting question to look for smooth, asymptotically flat solutions for D1, D5, KK. So it's T4 going along for the ride everywhere here, but I'm just going to neglect that. It doesn't play any role. Okay, so one can make good use of all these of work on sort of classifications of general solutions, Harvey et al. And that leads you quite readily to this sort of ansatz. Okay, so if K and S are one forms. If K and S were absent, this would just be the standard harmonic function ansatz for D1, D5. KK, I have the Taub-Nut space sitting there. And so the new feature is, twofold. I have these harmonic functions one forms, K and S. And I'm also not going to have the Z1 and Z5 just be 1 over R harmonic functions. I'm going to let these things eventually be sourced on some ring. Okay, so I've just written out the taubnut here thing for taubnut metric for convenience. Now, as I said, we're going to be demanding U1 cross U1 symmetry throughout. Okay, it's an interesting question to generalize these things more, but it's not something we've really looked at yet. So the one forms, so they have components in the psi direction. That's this compact direction of the taubnut space, and in the phi direction, on the that's just the polar direction of the R3. Okay, and the components only depend on R and theta. So that's the one form K. S has exactly the same sort of structure. And Z1 and Z5 also demand that those are independent of psi and phi. Okay, so we can take this ansatz and then boil the BPS equations down to something fairly simple. So this one form S has to be, if I take DS, that has to be self-dual on this taubnut space. Okay, so that everything here is referring, the star 4 is referring to the taubnut base, the four-dimensional space. DS is self-dual. A, defined as this combination, is anti-self-dual, and Z1 and Z5 are harmonic. These all hold, of course, away from sources. They're localized deviations from these equations. Okay, so everything's boiled down to solving these equations. I've suppressed, of course, the remote field strengths and the dilaton and so forth, but those are all similar. Okay, so when it solves those equations, and of course the hard part is to actually get something non-singular out of this construction. So we want to do something similar to the construction of the supertubes and the black rings. So we're going to take the harmonic functions Z1 and Z5 to have this 1 over sigma source. And on this R3 base, sigma now just corresponds to having a charge on the R3 located at a distance R tilde on the z-axis. So the way to think about this physically is it's located off the z-axis. It's a point in the R3, but it's sitting on the taubnut, so it's constant over the taubnut fiber. So it's like taking the D1, D5 brains and then distributing them uniformly around this Kaluza-Klein circle, this taubnut circle. So that's our assumption for Z1 and Z5, that they are harmonic. Okay, so then once we've done that, the remaining issue is to find, if I define theta plus and theta minus in terms of DS and DA, we want to find U1 cross U1 invariant closed two forms. That's what the previous equation said. And there's a nice construction of these things. In fact, you can relate such two forms to harmonic functions on this R3 base of taubnut. Okay, so how does that work? Let's write the taubnut space now in Cartesian coordinates. So A is the monopole vector potential. So the construction, the claim is that if you let P minus and ZK times P plus be harmonic functions on R3, assuming the symmetry, they're independent of phi, given those harmonic functions, then you can construct theta plus and theta minus simply by these formulas, and they'll be indeed closed and self-dual or anti-self-dual. Okay, so we can just verify that by direct computation. Once you know theta plus and theta minus, then from these equations you can obtain the one forms just by integrating. Okay, so the nice thing about this is that one can start by looking right at harmonic functions and then work backwards to the one forms. And so there's a natural, the one forms themselves eventually are complicated, but it's sort of there's a natural class of harmonic functions to start with, because the natural thing to write down are these harmonic functions, some constant piece, and then R equals zero is a special point, sigma equals zero is a special point, so let's just, let's write down arbitrary coefficients, C's and D's, write down these harmonic functions, and then solve the equations and then fix all the coefficients or fix as many coefficients we can simply by demanding the solution smooth everywhere and asymptotically four-dimensional. Okay, so there are potential singularities here in this construction. One can't just write down arbitrary coefficients. So at R equals zero, there are going to be potential singularities. At sigma equals zero, there are going to be singularities. And since we have a taubnut space in the game, there are Dirac Meissner strings at sine theta equals zero. These all have to be checked. So these are all free coefficients, and the radius of the charge, or the radius of the ring, R tilde that I wrote down as it was a free parameter at this point. And eventually these all get fixed uniquely by demanding smoothness. Okay, so...
How many parameters do you end up
having? So we only end up, well, so there'll be, if you demand smoothness, then there are no free parameters beyond the compactification moduli. So just the radius of there, then everything else is fixed. And I'm going to relax smoothness in a second. I'm going to allow for Zn orbifold singularities, like in the super tubes with multiple windings. And so then that'll be the only other parameter. So it'll be some discrete parameter labeling a Zn singularity.
But you have your charges, right? You have the solution. You get one unique solution for every
D5. Exactly. So you get to choose my integer charges, and then right. Those are also free
one
parameters.
Global charges.
Yes, exactly.
So in this case, you're not going to have the breathing the wiggle, the shape of the tube.
That probably that well, as I said, I fixed U1 cross U1 invariance.
Right.
So.
Right.
I put that in by hand. So there should be some other. Well, probably some other parameters. So we know we find all the, from the CFT point of view, we find all the chiral primaries we expect, all the chiral primaries with the symmetry. But we know there are more chiral primaries without that symmetry. So there should be some other solutions out there. Okay, so one goes through all the work in this project is basically checking that all those things are, that all the singularities go away, and I'm skipping all those details. So one, the radius of the ring happens to be determined by this formula. Okay, R5 is one of the compact. That's the essentially the radius where the D1 is wrapped around. So as I said, one gets a four-dimensional metric. There's the T4, and the two compact directions were this Kaluza-Klein direction and this X5 direction. Okay, one reads off, does a Kaluza-Klein direction in four dimensions, reads off the asymptotic metric, and there reads off all the charges. The mass is given by the Q1 plus Q5 plus Qk. And as I said before, the semi-unexpected point was that there's two gauge fields here, X5 corresponding to Kaluza-Klein gauge fields for these two compact directions. And there are no charges under this gauge field, but the psi gauge field, by construction, we sort of knew that thing was going to have magnetic charge because we put in the Taub-Mutt space. But then it also ends up carrying electric charge. And these are the formulas I mentioned at the very start of the talk. So it carries angular momentum. The angular momentum is 1/2 times the product of the electric charge times the magnetic charge, which is, as I said, a nice relation from electromagnetism. Okay, so everything is fixed like that if you demand smoothness everywhere. But we know from the constructions of super tubes that smoothness is really too strong. You should allow. So what's happening is the D1, D5 are expanding into a Kaluza-Klein monopole supertube. If you put Kaluza-Klein monopole supertubes on top of each other, as I discussed, you get a Zn singularity, and that's a perfectly allowed singularity in string theory. So we should allow for Zn singularities corresponding to the coincident Kaluza-Klein monopoles. And it turns out once one has the smooth solution, introducing those is trivial. Basically, you modify this relation. You stick in some factor of n. So I'm going to allow for Zn singularities. What happens to the charges? The only change in the charges is that J and the electric charge both get reduced by a factor of n. So you maintain this relation between J and the electric magnetic charges.
So in the naive metric, before when you fixed up the singularity, you had, you basically went down to a horizon, but the horizon was singular and had the zero area. Now, in your solutions, does the space end before you get to that horizon? I mean, does it somehow cut off the radius of the ring?
This next picture may help. It's analogous to what happens in the, if you know the story for the D1, D5, KK solutions, right? Something happens in the full six-dimensional geometry where instead of sort of going down to zero, the whole thing caps off smoothly into some smooth space. So it's a more complicated version of that same mechanism, but basically it's the same idea. Yeah, okay, so this will help us see why the thing is not singular, and if one wants to make identify that one has the right charges to map onto the chiral primaries, but one can also take the decoupling limit and then see it sort of very directly that you're getting the sort of the chiral primaries you expected. Because in fact, for these U1 cross U1 invariant geometries, the near horizon limit is actually quite simple. So in a sense, this will look misleading because the full asymptotically flat solution is quite complicated. And the near horizon limit is much more complex. Taking the near horizon limit is much more than just emitting some ones harmonic functions. You have to draw various other things. And at the end of the day, after you do a series of coordinate transformations after doing that decoupling limit, the metric is just ADS3 cross S3 mod Zn cross T4 with some extra conical defect that I'll state here in a second. So one gets global ADS. So the key thing here is that the near horizon geometry is global ADS, which is smooth as compared to Poincaré ADS compactified. One gets global ADS times S3, then one has this Zn identification on the S3, that's expected. And for this non-trivial n, which was allowing for the Zn singularities, you get this conical defect. So chi here is the angular direction in global ES. You go around 2 pi over n, that would be a conical defect, you know, singularity by itself, but you also go around in phi. Okay. Now, how can one understand a little bit about how the singularity is resolved? Well, let's go back. The potentially singular points of the original geometry were r equals 0 and sigma equals 0. So let's ask now, in this geometry, if I ask where those original points got mapped to when I did the coordinate transformation to this ADS region. So you have this S3 sitting here, and you find that r equals 0, which was where the Klutz-Klein monopole harmonic function was centered, maps into the center of ADS, r tilde equals 0, and then some great circle on the S3 at sine theta equals 0. Sigma equals 0, I think it's quite symmetric. It also maps to the center of ADS, but to some non-intersecting circle. So here it looks like the circles intersect because I've drawn S2, but this is really on S3. These are non-intersecting points. And so you sort of separated out the charges. They've been mapped to sort of smooth rings that separated non-intersecting points. And then the whole solution caps off smoothly and is healthy. Okay, well, I can finish a little bit early, in fact. Let me summarize, make some comments. So as I said, we found these non-singular three-charge solutions representing the ground states of the D1, D5, KK system, so we understand the ground states of the four-dimensional black hole. And let me mention as a side point, the original way that these D1, D5 geometries were found, smooth D1, D5 geometries were found, was you took the BMPV black hole and you take a non-extremal BMPV black hole and you take an extremal limit where you keep the angular momentum non-zero. So you have an extremal thing with non-zero angular momentum, and that thing actually is this D1, D5 supertube. And so one could have tried to take the known non-extremal four-dimensional black hole and try to do a similar construction, and that never seemed to work when I did it. And I was always puzzled why. And I think the reason why it didn't work is that, as we saw, you get this extra electric charge coming along in the construction, sort of forced upon you. And so trying to take this limit of the non-electric charge black hole simply wouldn't get this solution. Now, a couple extra minutes, let me mention that the reason you get geometrically this Klutz-Klein electric charge is that if one looks at the coordinate transformation that takes the full asymptotically flat thing into this solution here, there's some, so the angular momentum comes from, you have momentum circulating around the Klutz-Klein direction of this Taub-Nut space. And that direction actually gets misaligned with the rotation direction of the R3 at infinity. It gets partially aligned in that direction of the angular momentum, but also is partially aligned along one of the compact Klutz-Klein directions at infinity. So it's misaligned, so that original momentum translates both into angular momentum at infinity and Klutz-Klein electric charge. So that's why it's come. So you can sort of see it geometrically. Okay, now, I said this in response to Gary's question earlier, that one could take this thing and dualize to D1, D5P, but you don't get, you're not really in the regime where you would be explaining black hole entropy simply because you get a smeared D1, D5P system. Now, I argued that we hopefully can use this to resolve the singularity of these black rings. We could sort of take this construction here and sort of paste it into the local geometry of the black rings in some way that would resolve that singularity. And then, of course, an interesting question about what is the generalization here to solutions where you break this U1 cross U1 invariance. Two possibilities. One is you take some more harmonic functions in one forms that break the symmetry, but you still put this on Taub-Nut. Or more likely, one shouldn't be working with a Taub-Nut base at all. The Taub-Nut has the symmetries built into it. Probably need to deform that to some other hyper-Kähler metric and go from there. Okay, thanks.
So just on this last point, so if you want to generalize, so you could start by keeping the Taub-Nut the same. You wrote down what the equations were for supersymmetry, and they looked linear.
Yeah.
So if you simply choose arbitrary curves, you know, to put your sources, you get harmonic functions with those sources. Well, and then you would have to check that, you know, the singularities go linear, that arbitrary curve. Is there some reason to think that's not going to work?
Well, what confuses us is that, see, these are really, the sources are defined on, where'd it go? So, why did I lost it? Well, Okay. Oh yeah, right. So from this formula, the harmonic functions were had this source, and this source is a point in R3, and then extends around the circle of the tub nut. So there's no freedom to move the curve because in R3 it's just a point. It's not a curve on R3. And so where exactly to let it sort of there's no sort of place for it to naturally sort of wiggle into. That's why I'm puzzled.
But your equations were that they were harmonic on the Taub nut, right?
That's right. They're harmonic on the Taub nut. At this point, I'm demanding this symmetry. So I could.
If you just relax the symmetry, take an arbitrary curve on Taub nut, not require that it be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then you could find a harmonic function with the source.
Yeah, and I think that's right. That's a good suggestion. So the question then would be, right, whether make this thing be non-singular.
So didn't you say in your comment that because you had this, if you do a smear d1, d5, dp, you wouldn't be explaining the black hole entropy? I mean, I understand that if you dualize it trying to use the usual rules for supergravity, you get a smeared solution. But if you wouldn't you expect that you created the duality in string theory, you would relocalize? Or said differently, if you could prove that these were all, that some generalization of these, which had the right number of them, were all of the appropriate least symmetric three-charge solutions in this description, wouldn't that be a dual description of the black hole microstates?
Well, but you see, I mean, you want to write down some geometries which asymptotically look like the black hole solution that you're trying to explain, but then differ as you go in.
There are two things one could try to do, right? One could try to do Samir Mathur's program, which would be exactly what you just said. Mm-hmm. That you want something which you're explaining in the same duality frame what the microstates are. You'd like to replace the black hole solution by a set of microstates.
Yeah.
Or you could have a different idea of how the black holes might work. You might believe the black holes could be dual to some set of microstates, but you only see a different duality frame. That is, that you would keep the black hole solution in that duality frame, but this would be just a T-dual description of it.
Okay, so
this seems very consistent with that point. Remind you of a discussion you and I had last week about these two-charge systems, R-squared and black.
Okay, no, that's a good point. Yeah, I was thinking when I made a statement, I was thinking about it in terms of the Mathur point of view about trying that's a good point.
So if you could generalize these things, you'd really like to know how many you found.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll get to work.
So in four dimensions, you're saying you've got solutions which are completely regular, no horizon, and they're asymptotically flat.
Right.
So there's a theorem in four dimensions, the neural dimensions theorem, which basically says they don't exist.
No. I worried about that.
What theorem? Okay.
These are not four dimensions. They're not non-singular in four dimensions.
Well, you said
No.
Oh, I meant there's 10-dimensional metrics that are non-singular.
Non-singular. They're asymptotically fine. So they're just like the Kleitzer-Fine monopole.
Mm-hmm. But if they're analogous to the D1, D5 metrics that the theorem collaborators constructed, then you can reduce those down to five dimensions against something regular. So that assumed here you could reduce these down to four dimensions and everything would remain regular.
I'm
guessing thinking about the case of momentum. Okay, that's a good
one.
Yeah.
They're probably in six dimensions. They keep this not singular.
You're right, yeah. So in this case, you need the extra charge.
Sorry, what does this theorem say? It's in four dimensions.
In four dimensions, there are no stationary asymptotically flat solutions with a single asymptotic region.
Uh-huh. Basically, there are no solitons.
No stationary solitons.
Four dimensions. Not singular stationary solutions.
I see, okay.
But in high dimensions where you can have Chern signs to convert. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Or even without Chern signs. Yeah. If you could even across time.
Oh, but that's not asymptotically flat.
Well, it is important. I mean, higher dimensional gravity is not twisting. It's like having Chern sinusoidal anyway, right? You get Chern sinusoidal, you can usually reduce gravity. So if you can do it with Chern sinus terms, you can almost certainly do it with vacuum solutions at a sufficiently high dimension.
I'm
confused about one point. You say the solutions you find are angular momentum. So you say that the microstates for the 4D black hole have angular momentum, but the 4D black holes don't have angular momentum themselves. So how can that work out?
Right. So the BPS 4D black hole has no angular momentum. That's right. So I mean, the solution with you know, with entropy is given by is essentially averaging over all these microstates. So you're canceling out the.
Well, what I thought usually the picture was that the microstates have the same properties as the black hole, at least that's what the first looking for.
Have the same properties. So it's so I what I'm saying here is this is the same as just let's just take the ordinary D1 D5 system, and so just for pure D1 D5, there's this naive metric of the system which has no angular momentum and is singular, and then there are the microscopic geometries which are non-singular. Microscopic geometries all have, well, most of them have angular momentum. But we still but this is an absence. Just forget about the momentum. I'm just making a statement about the D1 and D5 system. So just the pure D1 and D5 system, right? Sort of the naive metric has no angular momentum, but all we know in the CFD that the microstates do have angular momentum. And so, so I'm claiming there's a perfect analogy between that and the 4D black hole. So we know from the CFT that the microstates have angular momentum for the 4D black hole. These are remote ground states which carry R charge. So that we know without a question. But we just don't know those class of geometries. We only know some. Well, maybe you're asking the question when you turn on the momentum. So if I take the four-dimensional black hole with momentum, I turn on P. Now what happens there? The reason you don't get angular momentum there. Is that there you don't have these little component strings. When you turn on momentum, in the black hole phase, you have one long component string. And so you're losing all these fermion zero modes. So there's nowhere, you can't carry angular momentum.
Imagine so this combination, just like your suggestion for explaining black hole entropy. If you have a BMPV sector and you have something with single long strings that gives you the dipole. So you have something similar, you could imagine having it for the black hole too. Except that then you would predict to have
supersymmetric
4D black holes
for angular momentum. Yeah, you could. That's right. From the CFT, you could ask, are those extra states? We know about in the black hole phase, the known black hole solutions correspond to where you just have one long component string. We don't know of other solutions. Mm-hmm. And now we also know solutions where you have just a bunch of little component strings. We don't know of any solutions where you have partially a long string and then some little component strings. We just don't know such solutions.
So another question is, in the CFT, where you include the Kutta-Klein monopole, they have the free charges, net charges. Is it possible then that the open string modes can be charged under the R symmetry as they can without the Kutta-Klein monopole?
Can the open string? Can the open strings carry the R symmetry? So the open strings are carrying the R symmetry, and the open strings are corresponding to the fermion zero modes, which have charges under the R symmetry.
If you compare the two, there's two ways of carrying the momentum. One is the supertube way, or the D1 to 5 carrier.
Yeah.
And the other one is the open strings carrying the SMBMPD.
Okay, I'm not following. Maybe we should discuss it afterwards, yeah.
If anyone's interested in getting for dinner with Pat, you might have information for Dom.
They should drop me an email, let them know they're coming, and we're probably going to go to Ani, the Japanese restaurant, in Middle State at 6 o'clock. And I will also be there.
Okay. Thank you very much.